Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. After 11 months and more than 1,000 interviews, the House Committee to Investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol will present new material documenting the attack, question witnesses, and provide the public with an initial summary of its findings about the coordinated effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election and prevent the transfer of power. The first hearing begins tonight at 5 p.m. Pacific time. The hearings will air live on all of the major networks, with the exception of Fox. Fox says the network will air the hearings as, quote, news warrants. Representative Benny Thompson is chairing the hearings. Six Democrats are majority committee members, and two Republicans are minority committee members. Here is a reminder of what happened on January 6th, 2021. This is a clip from the Frontline documentary, Trump's American Carnage.
We will stop the steal. We're going to walk down to the Capitol, and I'll be there with you.
They have been summoned by the President of the United States.
We fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Scuffles breaking out as Trump supporters gather in support of his effort to stay in power.
Madam Speaker, members of Congress, pursuant to the Constitution and the laws of the United States,
They have stormed the U.S. Capitol, and something else that should be noted, they have done so with ease.
It happened very quickly that the mob ran over the first barricades that were really just bicycle racks and then ran up the steps.
Stand aside and let us in, you traitors!
This is the United States of America, and we're watching protesters try to undermine the course of an election.
The situation is getting out of control, but it has turned insane, frankly.
I could not believe when they actually were able to shatter glass that I had assumed was bulletproof. They were able to wedge open what I thought was the strongest door on earth.
Their goal, to overturn the presidential election.
The GOP, Mitch McConnell.
We're debating a step that has never been taken in American history. I've served 36 years in the Senate. This will be the most important vote I've ever cast.
The mob was hunting Republicans who turned on Trump. It was the final chapter of Donald Trump's presidency.
It's ending pretty much the same way it began, with a lot of chaos and disarray and just a lot of head shaking at events that have transpired.
This is Donald Trump's America.
That is a clip from the Frontline documentary, Trump's American Carnage. A Senate report found that four people in the crowd lost their lives on January 6th. In the days and weeks after the insurrection, five police officers on duty that day died. Officer Jeffrey Smith took his own life 9 days later. His widow, Erin Smith, said, quote, "If he did not go to work that day, he would be here," end quote. At least 861 people have been charged in the insurrection so far, according to an insider database. 306 have entered guilty pleas. On Monday, five members of the Proud Boys, the right-wing extremist group, were indicted for seditious conspiracy. The Department of Justice said they worked to dismantle barricades, destroy property, and assault Capitol Police. Four of the five members previously served in the military, according to military.com. Michael Jensen, a senior researcher at the University of Maryland who studies extremism, told military.com, quote, "What we saw in the lead-up to January 6th was that veterans were the ones making the decisions about how the group was going to behave, how it was going to organize on January 6th, end quote. And we also should be reminded that when the Senate and House reconvened on the evening of January 6th, eight Republican senators and 139 representatives voted to overturn election results. Joining us to talk about what is at stake are two guests. Alex Shepard is a staff writer with the New Republic. Hi, Alex. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
Great to have you. Ellie Mistal is justice correspondent and columnist for The Nation and author of the New York Times bestselling book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Hi, Ellie. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Ellie, I was listening to an interview you recently did with People for the American Way, and you say that the Republicans have really dominated the narrative about what went on that day, and it's really important to remind people what exactly happened. So what do you think we need to be reminded of right now?
I mean, I think from the clip that you just played, you saw that on the day of the attack, even the Republicans understood the serious threat to democracy and what they had just lived through, right? You played a clip from McConnell, Lindsey Graham sweating that night as he said that he was done with Trump. But what happened? And what happened over the last 18 months is that Republicans have changed the narrative about this attack on our Capitol into like a tour bus that got a hand, which is not what happened. People need to be reminded that but for the heroic actions of Officer Eugene Goodman, who led the insurrectionists on a wild goose chase, Congress people could have been captured, hurt, and potentially killed. But for the heroic actions of staffers who had the presence of mind to secure the physical electoral ballots and shuttle them out to secure location before the insurrectionists ransacked the Senate parliamentarian's office, the entire election would have been thrown into chaos as the chain of custody of those ballots was broken. They came extremely close to succeeding in their coup against the American government. And for 18 months, we haven't heard that story. So the most important thing, I think, of these hearings is to refocus Americans on what actually happened, how it could have been worse.
Alex, what would you add? What do we need to be reminded of today?
Yeah, I think Ellie makes a very good point. And one of the things that has been so successful about the Republican counter narrative on January 6th is that they've essentially sequestered the violence at the Capitol. They've divorced the violence at the Capitol away from a months long process to steal the election. And they've essentially made the case that, you know, there are a few bad apples, a few militia connected members, you know, guys in the Proud Boys. These folks got out of hand. We don't like those people. But, you know, otherwise, it was just this kind of thing that went a little crazy. And No, this is the culmination of a long, concerted effort that, you know, President Trump and his allies were working. It was essentially all they were doing in the lead up to the election itself, and then certainly in the weeks that followed. And I do think that that narrative has been lost. And I think what the committee has to do in these hearings is make the case that what happened on January 6th was not a sort of one-off thing. It was a part of this much longer and very aggressive plot to overturn a legitimate election. And I think that the other challenge that they have, frankly, is that to an extent we sort of know the basic contours of what happened that day, that this was an effort to again, overturn a legitimate election. But we do not know a host of other things, including what President Trump was doing for this 3-hour period when rioters overtook the Capitol. But I think also the degree of coordination between members of Trump's inner circle and people at the Capitol itself. I think that's going to be one of the big questions going into the hearings today and then as they continue into the fall.
Right. That is such an important question. And we'll elaborate on that in a bit. But going back to your point, Ellie, about how Republicans initially responded, it is important to remind everyone that last May, you had 217 Democrats and 35 Republicans voting for a January 6th commission. But on the Senate side, Republican leader Mitch McConnell, and you heard that clip and that piece, opposed the bill and expected colleagues to follow suit, according to The Guardian. So you had 50 Democrats and only 6 Republicans voting to advance the bill, but it failed to overcome the filibuster. And then 3 months later, Speaker Pelosi said we have to establish some kind of commission.
Yeah, look, it's part of this is going to require some media discipline here, right? When Republicans make their claims that this is a partisan commission, that this is only run by Democrats or whatever they're going to say, the media needs to be on the ball and remind people that Republicans had every opportunity to participate in the investigation into what happened and what involving the attacks against the American government, and the Republicans refused to participate. They refused to advance the bill in the Senate. As you mentioned, they refused to put their members on the select committee that Nancy Pelosi construed in the House. They refused to help. So they can't now say, oh, well, nobody asked us, or this is just a partisan witch. No, you could have helped. You chose not to. And so now the committee looks the way it does.
You know, to your point about media, Ellie, I just want to bring up two tweets that caught my attention this morning. Victor Picard, a professor at the Annenberg School for Communications at Penn, said, I'm curious to see if news media cover today's hearings as the strategic maneuvers of two opposing sports teams or as a reckoning with ongoing threats to democratic governance. I'm predicting the former, but I'd love to be wrong. And then Dr. Dana Young, professor of communications at the University of Delaware, tweeted, today is going to be maddening. Journalists will be tempted to cover the hearings like they cover everything else as a strategic game between two political sides, downplaying anything we already knew and framing it in terms of how it will play for Dems in the midterms. What are your thoughts about the media's role in all of this?
I mean, those two tweets are accurate, right? Like the we kind of understand that our politics is broken, that Congress is broken, that Senate is gridlocked, but people also need to understand that the Fourth Estate is deeply broken. And we're going to see that brokenness, that cry for help almost, all across our screens over the next few weeks, as I think, as the people you quoted mentioned, as the media seems incapable of covering this in any way other than a horse race, right? In any way other than political machinations of one party versus the other, as opposed to a shared commitment to democracy, right? We have a media right now that thinks being kind of objectively pro-democracy is some kind of indication of partisan bias simply because many members of one party have turned against democracy. Well, that's not how it should be. It's not too much to ask that the media have an objectively pro-democracy slant to their coverage, but they won't. And we will see that, I think, play out over the next days and weeks. And that will be, again, good media. People on their own kind of power need to push back against these false narratives and, frankly, demand better coverage from the media and turn off or reject the media that's not giving it to you.
What do you think about this, Alex?
I think going off that point, it's worth drilling down on one particular aspect, which is that, you know, these hearings themselves are not likely to alter the midterm picture for Democrats. And look, that's fine, right? Because what we're talking about here is an existential threat to American democracy. It's probably the most important story in the country and has been, frankly, for the last 7 years, but particularly since November of 2020. But what you're seeing in the lead up to this is this obsessive focus already on will this make a difference in November or not for Democrats. And I think that this also points to another aspect in which our industry is broken, because it can only be seen through the lens of this kind of mythical swing voter or, you know, the guy in a diner in the middle of the country. And if that person, this hypothetical person, doesn't care or isn't seen to be caring about this, then oftentimes these stories get buried. Now, there are other bigger stories in terms of the midterm results, things like, you know, inflation, gas prices, whatever. But this should not be how assignment editing works, particularly at newspapers, but also on cable news as well. And I think that one of the things that that worries me going into this is that these are only going to be refracted through this lens of the midterms, when, again, the story here is so much more important than that.
And also the bigger story, I'm hoping to see some through lines. I'm not sure it's going to happen. But Ellie, I think about an interview we did back in 2017 with historian Nancy MacLean about her amazing book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. She looks at the history about how Koch brothers, James McGill, Buchanan, a political economist, radical right players, libertarians, basically knew that if they sold their ideas to the people, they'd never go for it. And so therefore we need minority rule, which is what we have right now. And then you need to go a couple years from here, 2022, 2024, As of April, 229 bills have been introduced or are under consideration in 33 states that allow state legislatures to politicize, criminalize, or interfere with elections, according to Protect Democracy. So what about the bigger picture here, looking at the past and then looking ahead?
Right. So the plot to steal the election did not stop on January 6th. Right. It is an ongoing. We are experiencing an ongoing slow moving coup and rejection of popular democracy. And that didn't start on January 6th and didn't end on January 7th. We have forces putting in place the structures to make future election overturning decisions in 2022 and 2024. Like, one of the reasons, and I don't want to speak out of turn here, but like, one of the reasons the coup failed is because it was too incompetent, right? Like, they started from too far behind. They only started to try to overturn the election after the results of the election were already tabulated and counted and publicized. They didn't start early enough. Now they're not trying to discard votes that have already been tabulated and counted. They're trying to prevent those votes from being counted and tabulated in the first place, right? And that's an entirely different kind of way to go about doing a coup. But that's what they're doing. Part of what the January 6th committee needs to do, and part of what the House and the Senate need to do, the reason why we have congressional oversight is not just to point blame and to point fingers, but it is to come up with new laws to better protect ourselves from the people who are attacking us. And you would hope that, you know, we can have a whole different conversation, and I'm sure we will, about criminal prosecutions. But in terms of just the raw function of Congress, it is to pass good laws. These hearings should point the way to good laws that should be passed and must be passed. And the public needs to have, you know, kind of activism around getting Congress and the broken Senate to pass these laws.
What kind of laws would you like to see?
I mean, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act is right there.
Right.
An act saying that you can't overturn elections based on state-level electoral board decisions, right? There are lots of things out there that we have that can stop this stuff, but we don't have the will in Congress, and especially the Senate, to overcome the segregationist filibuster in order to pass those laws that I am sure President Joe Biden would sign.
Alex, what would you add? Because we should also say that you've got 57 insurrectionists running for office in November, including Doug Mastriano, the Republican nominee for governor in Pennsylvania. And then according to reports, the MAGA wing of the party is putting a, quote, army of election workers together. I mean, they are moving at a very rapid pace.
Yeah, it's worth noting, too, that in Pennsylvania, Doug Mastriano would have the power to appoint the Secretary of State there, which is, you know, an incredibly important role in these things. And one of the things that's been maddening about the response to this from the Democratic Party, frankly, is that we know more or less how this is going to go in 2024, right? We know it's going to come through secretaries of state. We know it's going to come through state legislatures. We know it's probably going to come through, you know, or through Congress, right, depending on how many insurrectionists or election deniers there are there. And I think there has been a really, really weak effort to stop this, in part because there's been so little movement on the filibuster, I think, but also because I think there still is this faith among many in party leadership, particularly the older folks in party leadership, that simply making the case to the American people about what happened is enough to do this. Simply just going to the media and releasing these findings will do this, and they need to actually sit down and pass some laws, because there has been, you know, I think, a remarkable effort on the right. You know, in 2020, what happened was they essentially tried to build the coup airplane in midair, and now they're actively preparing for 2024. And I don't think it's safe to assume that just because they were incompetent the last time, they will be this time.
Can I just piggyback really quickly on something Alex is saying? Because it's,
please.
It, I, I feel like people forget, this isn't the first time Republicans have tried this. I am old enough to remember 2000 Bush v. Gore. And what happened in Bush v. Gore? Well, the Republicans, as soon as that election was close, as soon as the tally in Florida was in dispute, Republicans descended upon Florida with lawyers, with activists. They already had the Republican Secretary of State, Kathleen Harris, in place to do their bidding. The Republicans were ready to make sure Florida went the way they wanted it to go. Democrats and the Gore campaign were caught completely flat-footed. I remember I was a first-year law student at the time. The Democrats had no lawyers on the ground. They had no army on the ground to protect their interests and to protect Gore's interests. I can't understand how 20-odd years later we're in the same situation. I can't understand how 20-odd years later the Republicans are once again filling up with lawyers, with activists, with secretaries of state, and the Democrats are still not there.
You make such a good point about the year 2000 and how all that went down. What are your thoughts, Ellie, about how Dems are talking about January 6th, about how Biden is talking about January 6th?
I mean, the Democrats are so it's like they're afraid of their own shadow, right? They're so afraid of sounding partisan about it that they're not making their best arguments for what happened, why, and what we need to do about it. They haven't been laser focused on January 6th for the past 18 months like the Republicans generally have. They haven't been, again, like I said, putting in place the structures and the infrastructure and the guardrails to stop what Republicans are clearly saying they're trying to do. So, I don't want to do the mistake that I just accused the media general of doing, and I don't want to all look at this in terms of a horse race, political machinations, maneuvering kind of scenario. There is a real objective problem here. I do not think the Democrats have been as effective as they could be at making the objective reality of our situation as known and as obvious to the American people as it should be.
Ellie Mistal is justice correspondent and a columnist for The Nation and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Alex Shepard is a staff writer with The New Republic, and we are talking about tonight's first January 6th hearing. It'll begin at 5 p.m. Pacific time, airing live on all of the major networks, with the exception of Fox, and we'll talk about that in a bit. If you have any questions about what we are going to see or what we expect tonight, what is at stake, what are your thoughts on the questions that still need to be answered? We've got about 10 more minutes in this segment. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Ellie, a lot of people are saying the big question, like Alex said, is where was Trump during those 3 hours? What are some of the big questions you would like to see addressed tonight?
Yeah, so we have a federal force called the National Guard that can be deployed when there is, I don't know, an attack on the government, right? We got people who are there do that. Those people were eventually called by Mike Pence after he got out of harm's way near the end of the evening. So I would like to know why Trump didn't call the National Guard, why he didn't do what was necessary to protect the Capitol. I think that is number one. Number two, I want to know whether or not these people had any inside help. As I said, the physical electoral ballots, the chain of custody, were in the Senate parliamentarian's office. Do you know how to get to the Senate parliamentarian's office? Because I don't. It's not on a map. It's not a well-signed office. Did you even know that the Senate parliamentarian was where they kept the physical electoral ballots? Because I didn't until January 7th. So how did these people even know how to get to the important office on that day? In fact, there are stories all over the place about people who were trying to get to congressmen. Jim Clyburn has a great story about how his office is actually like very well signed, right? People know where the House Majority Whip it works out of, right? But that Jim Clyburn doesn't work in his office. He works somewhere else in the Capitol, kind of a hidden secret place. And the insurrectionists went to the hidden secret place, not his actual office, to go try to find him. How did they know that? So there are legitimate questions about what kind of inside help or knowledge these people had on the day of the attacks. And then the third question that I don't know how else to put this, but like, Mike Pence was in real danger and he knew it. So why did Mike Pence know that he was in real danger? Who was Mike Pence telling to try to get him out of danger? And why wasn't the president helping Mike Pence get out of danger is, I think, a critical question on this day.
Alex, what are some questions you would like to see raised during these hearings?
Yeah, I think piggybacking off of
you brought up earlier.
Yeah, piggybacking off of one of Ellie's points, I think the most interesting thing to me is also how much coordination there was between Trump, his attorneys, other people close to his inner circle, and various secretaries of state and state legislatures. We know via Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State, a Republican who was viciously attacked by the president and his allies, that Trump was aggressively calling him to pressure him to essentially overturn the state's electoral count. And I want to know how sophisticated these efforts were, who was doing them, how coordinated they were, because similarly, you had the same arguments popping up again and again. Now, it is possible that these people were all just reading the same stories on right-wing websites at the same time when everyone was suddenly an election law expert in the lead-up to January 6th. But it seems quite clear that there was a very concerted effort by the president and his allies to push these arguments onto people. And we haven't quite gotten the full web of those connections yet. And I would like to see this committee expose that.
The other issue is, when we talked about this briefly earlier, is whether they are going to try this again. And Ellie, in interviews, you have said if they're not punished, they will try it again. And Ryan Boosie, author of Gunfight, My Battle Against the Industry That Radicalized America, tweeted, if you think January 6th can't happen again, go stand in a gun store right now and listen to the chatter. This, S-H-I-T, is deadly serious. So can you elaborate on that, Ellie? What are your thoughts about what will happen if people do not receive punishment for this?
A coup that is not punished is just practice for the next one. That is not me saying that. That is the experience of world history. We are not, Americans have a problem where they always think that we're the first people to do anything. We're not. We're a young country. The world is old. And we have seen this before. We have seen attempted coups where the people who organized it were either lightly punished or not punished at all. And what they do is try again. They always try again until they are stopped. So if we don't stop them here, and that means punishment, accountability, and jail time. If we don't stop them here, if this is not the line in the sand, then they're just going to do it again. They're going to try again and again and again. If they can't steal the election through the legal machinations that we talked about earlier, they will once again try to violently overthrow the results of an election they don't like. So I almost feel like I'm taking crazy pills when I say that, because that point is obvious, or it should be, to law enforcement. So at some point, like Merrick Garland, Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, these people got to get in the game, and they have to punish and hold accountable the people who attacked us.
What are your thoughts, Alex, especially on Trump's criminal liability?
Well, yeah, just to go off on that point really quickly, I think one of the things that frankly terrifies me about this is when you look back at the lead up to January 6th, what you saw was that Republicans were very, very comfortable with the legal machinations that Trump and his team were doing in an attempt to overthrow the election. And, maybe in some corners, it depends who you talk to. With some of them, it was because they believed that they wouldn't succeed. But I think with others, there was real comfort with stealing an election, however you want to call it, the boring way, we'll say. And one of my fears is that, the violence of January 6th was horrific. And I think, as Ellie said, it could very much happen again. But what Republicans are doing right now is they're setting up the legal infrastructure for a boring coup, one that doesn't have to rely on something like what happened in Florida in 2000. And I think that that is the thing that Democrats are not adequately preparing for at the moment. And when Republicans jumped ship, it was really only because they were alarmed by the violence that happened at the Capitol. And I think the fact that they were, many of their own were nearly put in danger. Now, Trump's criminal liability, I think, is complicated because you're talking a lot about stuff that is the question of what he didn't do, right? Why did he not send in the National Guard? But there has been a real unwillingness by Democrats, by Democrat appointees, particularly Merrick Garland, to even entertain these questions in a way that I think is really, really alarming. I think we're going to see a lot of exceptionally damning information in these hearings, but it's also going to be up to Democrats to make the case that this needs to go further, that this can't just be a replay of the impeachment hearings that we had in February of 2021. It has to go further. There needs to be actual accountability for those who took part in this coup, not just the hundreds of people that have been arrested, but also for the planners and executors of it. And I think foremost among them is Donald Trump.
We have an email from Bill who writes, too much of the DNC's time is occupied fighting progressive Democrats. To them, the enemy are the progressive Dems, at least as much as the Republican fascists and enablers. Thank you for that, Bill. And Art writes, what can you advise listeners to do about this besides watch tonight's hearing? Ellie?
Well, first of all, I don't know that Merrick Garland and Christopher Wray are fighting anybody. They're not fighting progressives. They're not fighting. And that's a big problem for me. So what can average people do? Well, two things. One, I do not believe that Merrick Garland will act and bring criminal prosecutions against these people without intense and immense public pressure. We know that Joe Biden will not put that pressure on him. That's probably actually fair. We don't want a repeat of the Bill Barr era. But public pressure on Merrick Garland is, I think, the only thing that could possibly motivate him to take, as Alex was saying, take what's going to be some serious new evidence and allegations about what these people have done, to take that evidence and turn those into charges and indictments. That's going to take a lot of public pressure. And so, like, being part of the public who pressures him is one thing a person can do. The other thing, and I've said this a couple of times, but like, as we've been talking about, the Republicans have an army of people that will be descending onto the states during this next election. If you are a person who believes in democracy, I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, I don't care if you share my ideals or not, but if you believe in democracy, sign up to be a poll worker. Sign up to be a poll watcher. Sign up to do one of these electoral hotlines where you can marshal people through their rights, because that's where this fight really is. It's an on the ground, in the trenches fight. Can people vote and have their votes counted? And we need as many people as we can get who are on the side of democracy, regardless of political affiliation.
What would you add, Alex?
I mean, I can just mostly just reiterate those two points, but I think that there's another thing to emphasize here, which is that the right has been, you know, mobilizing aggressively, particularly over the last few months, to prepare for this. I think the midterms will be the first kind of dry run to see what they can actually assemble. But the other thing as well is that I think there was a real sense of, I don't know what you would call it, shock fatigue during the Trump years, where I think you could just sort of get used to or accommodate yourself to just how horrific and strange every new story was. And I think with this, it's unfolded in similar fashion, in which we've had these sort of steady progression of leaks about what exactly happened. In some ways, it resembles Trump's first impeachment as well, where it's pretty clear what was going on. And then with each new development, it becomes more and more apparent. But I think that the danger with a lot of this is that people forget just how serious this is. And I think that's one of the challenges that the committee has in these primetime hearings, is to make the case that this is something that we should be horrified about and should also be mobilizing about. Because again, the right is mobilizing right now to prepare for 2024.
Before we end, I also just want to raise the issue of racism. And I wonder if racism is going to come up, and if so, how? Remember that there was a noose displayed on a gallows outside the Capitol. It's now in FBI custody. Also, on July 27th, Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn told a select hearing what he experienced that day. He said he had no independent reason to believe that violence was headed our way. Capitol Police were assaulted with weapons like flagpoles, metal bike racks, and various projectiles. Officers were screaming, bleeding, and coughing with chemicals. Officer Harry Dunn also described the racist abuse he faced from the rioters inside the Capitol building, where one carried a Confederate flag. Officer Harry Dunn is Black, and here is Harry Dunn speaking at that hearing.
More and more insurrectionists were pouring into the area by the Speaker's lobby near the rotunda, and some wearing MAGA hats and shirts that said Trump 2020. I told them to just leave the Capitol, and in response, they yelled, "No, man, this is our house. President Trump invited us here. We're here to stop the steal. Joe Biden is not the president. Nobody voted for Joe Biden." I'm a law enforcement officer, and I do my best to keep politics out of my job. But in this circumstance, I responded, "Well, I voted for Joe Biden. Does my vote not count? Am I nobody?" That prompted a torrent of racial epithets. One woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelled, "You hear that, guys? This nigger voted for Joe Biden." Then the crowd, perhaps around 20 people, joined in screaming, "Boo, fucking nigger." No one had ever called me a nigger while wearing the uniform of a Capitol Police officer. In the days following the attempted insurrection, other Black officers shared with me their own stories of racial abuse on January 6. One officer told me he had never, and in his entire 40 years of life, been called a nigger to his face, and that streak ended on January 6. Yet another Black officer later told me he had been confronted by insurrectionists in the Capitol who told him, "Put your gun down and we'll show you what kind of nigger you really are."
That was Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn telling a select hearing back in July what he experienced on January 6th. Ellie, we played that clip because I think it's so important to remind people of what those officers, Black officers, endured. How do you think this committee should discuss and, you know, deal with the racist elements of January 6th?
I've been interested in having a parallel discussion about how racism motivated these attacks on January 6th. I've in the past called them white supremacist attacks on the Capitol on January 6th, in parallel to the criminal investigation that needs to be taking place. But I am sorry to say that I just do not think that white America writ large, I don't mean everybody, I mean, you know, the majority of white America that voted for Trump. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's going to move the needle. I don't think they care, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they care that the people who attacked us were racist. I don't think that they care that the Confederate flag was marching in the capital of Washington, D.C., and a feat that Robert E. Lee couldn't pull off was finally pulled off on January 6th. I don't think enough white people care. And because put it like this, if we were going to have a racialized discussion about what really happened, it needs to start on the evening of January 6th, where FBI Director Chris Wray lets these people walk away. Can you that wouldn't have happened if that had been a predominantly Black crowd. If that had been a predominantly Black crowd that had attacked the Capitol, they would have walked out the Capitol into paddy wagons directly to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Instead, even today, every couple of days, we have another like, "Oh, the FBI finally arrested one of the Capitol rioters," right? Because they weren't arrested on the day. It took them 18 months. And then they went into the wind, and it took the FBI 18 months to find them again, right? That's racism right there, because we know it wouldn't have happened in the reverse. But America, I do not think is capable, white America, I do not think is capable of having that conversation in parallel to the criminal investigation and oversight that is taking place. And so I don't really think that it's going to be a factor, unfortunately.
Well, it's still so important just to remind people that that's what these officers had to endure that day. Ellie Mistal is a justice correspondent and columnist for The Nation and author of the New York Times bestseller, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Ellie, thanks so much for your work. We'd love to have you back, maybe during some other hearings, but also to talk about your book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Alex Shepard is a staff writer with The New Republic. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, the first hearing begins tonight at 5 p.m. Pacific time. This station will be airing it. It'll be live on all of the major networks, with the exception of Fox. We didn't have time to talk about this, but we do know that on Election Day, Fox host Sean Hannity was texting Mark Meadows for messaging instructions and responded to one of the texts, "Yes, sir." We will talk about that in our upcoming shows about the Capitol insurrection hearings. Coming up after a break, we are going to talk about Unite Here filing unfair labor practice charges against Amy's Kitchen. This is your call. We'll be back after this.